From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the New Hampshire Primary News Roundup on The Exchange. After months of anticipation, the Iowa caucuses end with confusion over who actually won, raising once again questions about how important early voting states like Iowa and New Hampshire should be. President Trump delivers his State of the Union address, laying out arguments for voters to take to the ballot box, and the impeachment trial comes to its expected conclusion. How have presidential candidates made sense of all this? All that and more on this, the last New Hampshire Primary News Roundup before primary day next Tuesday. Listeners, your voice is important, so we'd love to hear from you. And we want to start the program talking about Iowa today, so tell us what you think of all this. Does who wins in Iowa matter to you? How does what happened in Iowa make you feel about the voting process overall? Give us a call now, 1-800-892-6477. You can also send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org, or comment on Facebook, where you can watch a live streaming video of this radio program. Just go to Facebook and search for NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. Right now, we're going to talk with our panel of folks in the know, CBS reporter Nicole Skanga, Jake LaHut, politics reporter for Business Insider covering the 2020 primary, former reporter at the Keene Sentinel, Politico, and the Daily Gazette, and Paul Steinhauser, political reporter who's been writing for the Concord Monitor, Fox News, and other outlets. Thank you all very much for being here.
Great to be back.
So let's talk about Iowa. That's the big thing that we've been focusing on this week. I mean, it feels like this whole week has been like 3 weeks of news in 1 week, but let's do our best for this hour. Before we get into what we know as of Friday morning about the results of the Iowa caucuses, I believe we're pretty close to knowing, but you tell me, Paul Steinhauser, explain exactly what happened that caused the problems in Iowa.
Oh, what a mess. And what a huge black eye for Iowa, which could impact New Hampshire. But for the first time, they did a couple different things in Iowa. They were reporting not just the traditional state delegate equivalents, these SDEs. It sounds like a disease, but it isn't. That's always been the traditional way.
SDEs.
This cycle.
Easy to remember.
Yes, SDEs. This cycle, because of protests from 4 years ago when Bernie Sanders narrowly lost to Hillary Clinton,
right. They
reported the first and second round of raw votes from the caucuses. Because remember, out in Iowa, they have a caucus. You have a first round. If your candidate doesn't reach 15% at your caucus precinct, then that candidate's not viable, and their supporters can then go to another candidate. That's called the realignment. And so there are two rounds of voting. So three metrics were coming out this time. And for the first time, they were using this new reporting app. That's how the precinct captains at these caucus sites, well over 1,000 all across the state, were reporting back to Des Moines. Well, there were some glitches, obviously, with that app. And that's why we finally now, 4 days later, at 100%.
So, Paul, like, you were there in Iowa while this was happening.
Mm-hmm.
What did it seem like to you? Was it just chaos after a certain hour or what?
It was just bizarre because the state party wasn't making anybody available. They were being very cryptic with what was going on. The campaigns were understandably furious because they wanted results. And in the vacuum of not having results, we had candidates. Amy Klobuchar was the first to come out and say she had a great night. Pete Buttigieg came out and actually declared victory. The other candidates all said they were coming out of Iowa with momentum.
Joe Biden said he got his fair share, but he got no delegates, right?
Right. Yeah. As of that night, we didn't know. Nothing. We knew nothing. It was bizarre. And then finally, the next day, we got an initial amount of results. And finally, here we are on a Friday, and we are at 100% in Iowa. But there may be a re-canvass because the Democratic National Committee is now calling for it to be all done again. Well, this may be the first time in history where New Hampshire actually has the results before Iowa.
Well, I want to get Jake and Nicole's take on Tom Perez, chair of the Democratic National Committee's call for a re-canvass. Nicole, what do you make of just the fact that he is asking for this?
Well, it's huge. And, you know, as Paul said, this could be the first time that we have not seen Iowa results immediately after. And yeah, it is a black eye for the Iowa caucus, which has received an uptick in criticism recently, along with New Hampshire, the first in the nation primary and caucus states, for their lack of diversity. Now you have a caucus. Iowa, for many years, with the exception of, I believe, 2012, sort of got their caucus right. That was one of their defenses. When people criticized them being first in the nation, they were able to point to the fact that they've done this for a long time, that it's tradition, that they do a good job of it, that their voters are responsible. Now that argument falls just a little bit flat, and it could risk what happens here in New Hampshire.
Yeah, and Tom Perez is obviously in a tough spot here. There's been some reporting that he's kind of thrown the Iowa Democratic Party chair under the bus. Supposedly they gave him a 1-minute warning before Perez was going to tweet to call for this re-canvass. That could potentially, you know, lead to some fissures. And I do hate to kind of be the bearer of bad news here, but, you know, New Hampshire is not quite out of the woods, not just because of the fact that the fates of these two states are kind of tied together, but I've spoken to Bill Gardner on two occasions, and he's told me that basically, because we have no formal auditing process in this state for the machines that count paper ballots, which, you know, in the cities and more populated areas, that's the bulk of the vote. Obviously, there are a lot of towns that have your old school ballot box, paper, hand count, no big deal. But if there were to be some sort of issue with the machine, or more importantly, what really moves the needle on this is if a campaign were to raise an issue with such a thing. Bill Gardner has told me that a statewide recount could take around 3 weeks. He's obviously pretty optimistic and bullish on the primary. The last time this happened, I guess Dennis Kucinich and a pretty marginal Republican called for one in 2008, and that took 5 weeks. Now, neither of them are going to win, so the primary moved on. But when you have a really crowded field, and if someone feels incentivized to call the results into question, there could be a bit of a mess here. We also don't have a threshold, for example, on those machines. Like a state like Connecticut, for example, uses a lot of the same AccuVote machines that are used around this state. For those, I think it's if it's within a 0.5% margin, you have to recount the machines because of their propensity for human error and just for, you know, the regular irregularities that could occur. We don't have any of that in place. So, you know, even Bill Gardner said there could be a bit of a mess on our hands.
And we have so there was a press conference earlier this week where both Governor Sununu, Attorney General Gordon McDonald, and Secretary of State Bill Gardner, they were talking to the press about any concerns they may have going into the primary about whether or not when we'll get the results, the likelihood of an error, what they think is going to happen. So here's what Governor Sununu had to say about that.
In New Hampshire, when our citizens cast a ballot, they know their vote will be counted correctly, with integrity, and on time. And given the news and uncertainty out of Iowa, it's important that we assure the public that the systems we have in place here in New Hampshire are truly beyond reproach. We are the first of the nation primary state. And while Iowa has a caucus, we are the first true primary election of 2020 calendar, and we've earned that honor for the last 100 years. Getting it right is paramount, and New Hampshire has the track record to prove it.
So the state government feeling pretty bullish on our ability here in New Hampshire to get the accurate count, get it out in a timely manner, and even if not, have a paper trail. Seems like that's what's the message, right?
Yeah, and I was at that press conference there. You heard Governor Sununu say that while Iowa has a caucus, we have a primary. And so, you know, some of my colleagues made a note. It sounded like the governor was throwing a little bit shade. But New Hampshire has always made that distinction between a caucus and a primary. There are paper ballots that back up every single vote.
There's less math involved.
There's less math involved. And of course, then Secretary of State Bill Gardner got up and said, well, there's no app. There's no app.
He wouldn't even know what an app is, but that's a different story.
He likes the pencil, right? He's brought out pencils at press conferences and said, look, you can't hack this.
Yeah, exactly. Piece of paper and a pencil. But the full court press by New Hampshire is definitely a move to try to throw Iowa under the bus. Now, A, you're right. I mean, Iowa's bizarre. It's a caucus. There's only about 14 states left at caucus. And theirs is complicated. Two rounds, state delegate equivalents. It gets very confusing. This is an election. You go, you vote, you cast your ballot. But even before they had that show of force, I spoke Tuesday morning, just hours after the debacle in Iowa, with Ray Buckley, the chairman here, and he made the same point. You know, our elections here are administered by the state, not by the party. And he was kind of throwing Iowa under the bus because New Hampshire is terrified that they're going to lose their First Nation primary because of the snafus in Iowa.
Well, that's a distinction I wanted to draw and get Jake and Nicole to weigh in on as well, because going back to the Tom Perez and the Iowa Democratic Committee, how involved is Tom Perez in the day-to-day operations of the Iowa Democratic Party? The Iowa Democratic Party was running this caucus, not right. Tom Perez.
Right, right. And I think that's where there are already tensions emerging there. Bill Gardner also told me on Tuesday that he had some sort of conversation with Tom Perez a few months ago, along with the Iowa Democratic Party, about the measures they would put in. Now, in the grand scheme of things, it is kind of interesting that a Secretary of State who has nothing to do with the state of Iowa would be getting this kind of like up close briefing on such a thing. But the other thing I noticed about this call with Gardner, because I really do think this intertwined fate is really what's getting people tense. And Tom Perez told Rachel Maddow that, you know, he's fully willing to look into reevaluating the order of the states. So when I spoke to Gardner on Tuesday, and as these things tend to go, then your reporter who's talked to Bill Gardner goes on for a while. So, you know, we're talking and I'm kind of waiting for him to maybe, you know, have some sort of, like, I mean, we've been using the term throw under the bus, but maybe not that far, but at least you know, he was taking a victory lap, but when I really tried to drill him down on it, Bill Gardner was very hesitant to overly criticize Iowa. I mean, the furthest he went was he said that the whole debacle doesn't help their first in the nation status. But I really do think that as much as we may want to take a victory lap in New Hampshire about having a superior system, there is definitely a palpable sense of anxiety, particularly because the Democratic Party is raising points irrespective of the voting logistics. It's, I mean, it's about demographics, it's about representation, and all those important arguments.
Paul, big problem moving ahead was we were already under the microscope. You saw candidates like Julian Castro. You've seen candidates like Michael Bloomberg calling for a reordering of the primary nomination process, saying that New Hampshire and Iowa, with the lack of diversity, shouldn't be going first anymore. And that happens every 4 years. Now, because of what happened in Iowa, this is kind of feeding the fire, right?
Yeah.
We saw Debbie Dingell, the congresswoman from Michigan. Michigan has long pushed to move up in the order and kind of move Iowa and New Hampshire out. She just spoke out and talked about making a push now that would happen in Iowa. The fight next year, and that's really when it's going to start, though there will be discussions as well at the Democratic National Convention this summer in Milwaukee. It's going to be a tougher fight than ever. I bumped into Billy Shaheen, longtime Democratic National Committee member from him here in New Hampshire, saw him at the Biden event, and he's well aware that this fight that will continue on is going to be more vicious than ever before.
Nicole. And in Tom Perez's defense, the DNC, ever since the hacking that occurred last election cycle, has really been trying to bolster its own data machine at headquarters and hire a lot of folks from Silicon Valley to make sure that their data going into 2020 is up to snuff. They've often been outcompeted by Republicans in recent years. And so that's part of the reason that this comes as such a blow. Obviously, the DNC was not directly involved in what happened in Iowa, but it will suffer from criticisms thrown at the entire party.
Yeah, and the ultimate irony here is that the whole reason we had this three sets of data and the new app was because of complaints from the Sanders campaign about an archaic process the last time that, you know, I mean, you hear it from Sanders supporters at pretty much every event you cover. A lot of them still believe that the whole primary was rigged for Hillary. And these were reforms that were made to try to, you know, broaden the tent, keep everybody happy. And I mean, it just went completely in the opposite direction in terms of the credibility of the caucus.
Yeah. And Paul, Nicole, have you heard anything about the conspiracy theories that have just popped up as a result of Iowa? And anything from voters you may have encountered?
Not conspiracy theory, but more just a lack of confusion as to what is going on and who really won Iowa. People don't know.
People don't know. Nicole?
I will say I talked to probably 24 voters on Tuesday after the Iowa caucus and asked them, does this change your decision? Are you confused? Are you upset? And most told me not more than usual, right? One voter in Nashua told me, well, we always discount Iowa. And so, again, hearing a little bit of that shade from Granite Staters, but frankly, a lot of folks here feel like this is the first in the nation primary. The candidates have been visiting them as well for the past year. They've been paying close attention and they're going to make up their minds regardless.
Listeners, we'd love to hear from you on this as we continue to discuss the fallout from Iowa. Give us a call. The phone number is 1-800-892-6477 or send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Someone who did not leave their name wrote to us about Iowa and said, seems to me that worrying about getting the Iowa results before we cast our ballots here implies that Iowa gets to caucus us. If what they decide influences New Hampshire, how independent are our self-styled New Hampshire residents? Seems like a rhetorical question, but any comments on that listener's comment?
The Iowa results always have an impact on New Hampshire. We may not follow their lead, though. That's the thing. Often we'll vote contrary to the way Iowa, and this is not just for the Democrats, but also on the Republican side as well. So, but now you have a situation where you have two candidates. Pete Buttigieg declared victory on Monday night, and Bernie Sanders had a news conference here. He doesn't hold a lot of news conferences. He had one Thursday. I was there. He had his Manchester headquarters, and he declared victory. And again, he looked to the raw vote totals, the popular vote coming out of Iowa, rather than those state delegate equivalents.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, I think you hear from the occasional persnickety voter that they will vote in an inverse relationship to the Iowa caucus result. But that's, I think that's also just kind of tongue
in cheek. That's not a massive trend. That's just like,
yeah,
you know, anecdotally you hear from people.
Or even just someone wanted to have a little fun with a reporter, you know?
Gotcha.
Sure. I mean, in 2016, obviously, we know that New Hampshire went its own way, you know, with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders in 2008 went its own way. Iowa voted for then Senator Barack Obama. New Hampshire voted for then Senator Hillary Clinton. So they do have a tendency, of course, to sort of go their separate ways. I do think in some ways this does put the onus on on New Hampshire, there is no clear winner out of Iowa. We know that both Senator Bernie Sanders and former South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg have been doing very well here in the state. They both have solid operations. They've seen movement in polls in recent months. So in this case, New Hampshire could kind of tip the momentum to one or the other.
Well, on that momentum question, I mean, typically with the Iowa caucus, you wake up the next morning and there's one candidate who has their spot in the sunshine. Maybe they get a little bit more momentum because of that. That didn't happen for either of the candidates who are kind of tied, right? Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders. So, Paul or
yes
Jake?
Yes and no. Let's take it with Buttigieg. Buttigieg exceeded expectations in Iowa. His poll numbers kind of slipped throughout January. But he worked it hard in Iowa, and not just in the major urban areas. I was with him up in northeast Iowa, which is much more rural. He worked it hard, and he exceeded expectations. All of this got obscured a little bit, obviously, because we didn't have results. Sanders met his expectations, but he didn't exceed him. He was the front runner in Iowa, and if you average all the latest polls. So Pete Buttigieg got a huge bounce out of Iowa, and we're seeing that now here in New Hampshire. And Bernie Sanders is back in Bernie country and in a very good place. And the people who suffered, obviously, especially Joe Biden.
Okay, let's go to the phones and talk to Jim in Wolfboro. Jim, thanks for calling. What's your question or comment?
Good morning. I was wondering if there was still a problem of superdelegates. Are they still out there, or what's up with that?
Jim frames superdelegates as a problem. First of all, do they still exist?
Yes.
And are they a problem?
Debatable. That's everybody's opinion. But they lost their power in the first round of the Democratic National Convention. They don't vote anymore. They're tied. So they become a player if we get to a second round, which hasn't happened in, what, 50, 60 years?
Yeah, we'll see if we have a brokered convention or not. I think they're called automatic delegates now. That, again, is a reform that Senator Sanders pushed, but they no longer have their power in the first round. So we will likely not see what happened, at least in the first round in New Hampshire last time around, where Bernie Sanders won the popular vote in New Hampshire by a margin of over 20 points, but ended up with around the same number of delegates as Secretary Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, and not to add to the uneasiness or confusion here, and my apologies to Chairman Buckley, because this is one of the last articles I wrote for the Sentinel before joining Business Insider was about just, you know, Monadnock region local delegates, you know, getting picked by campaigns. So theoretically, we do not have bound delegates in New Hampshire. When you talk about a pledged delegate for a candidate, they could theoretically still vote for whoever they want on the convention floor on the first vote. So, I mean, ultimately, like when you explain the system, for example, to someone from a foreign country, you know, that's kind of what you learn in school. I taught English in Paris for a year, and the fundamental thing you have to get across to people is there still is this barrier of people on a convention floor, the way it's always been. Just the reforms post-1968 and that debacle have been to try to ensure that the voice of the people is, you know, more bound up in that.
Let's talk to Cameron in Manchester. Thank you very much for calling, Cameron. What's on your mind?
Hi, yes. I work as a ballot inspector here at Ward 3 in Manchester. We're right downtown. And I've been doing this for about 4 or 5 years, and I just wanted to share how confident I am in our paper ballot system. Mm-hmm. We do account for every ballot, including every ballot that hasn't been cast at the end of the night. And sometimes we're there until, you know, past midnight. So I just wanted to share, you know, how confident I am.
Cameron,
we have voter ID laws, and everything is really well oiled.
So can I ask you a little bit about your job, Cameron?
Sure, yeah. What I do is I ask a voter for their name and address and their photo ID, and all I basically do is just confirm that this is the person we have registered. We can match the photo ID to the person voting, and then I cross the name off the list of the registration, and then I give the voter either, depending on their party affiliation, a poker chip. It's either blue or red. And then they take that poker chip over to a table, and they exchange it for their ballot. And then they go to vote on the paper ballot, and at the end, they feed it into the counter, and at the end of the tabulator, and at the end of the night, the tabulator gives us the results.
I see. And the name ballot inspector sort of implies that you will be looking at the ballots afterwards. Is that the case? Like, are you taking them
it's
out of the machine?
It's a misnomer.
Okay.
Yeah, no. but I do help count the ballots at the end of the night, and basically we all work together. It really does come down to the people here in the community who volunteer to work as election officials. It's a very stressful job. The hours are very long and tedious, but it's something that I feel like is my civic duty. to help, you know, champion democracy.
Certainly.
And to be part of that just feels incredible.
And Cameron, we have a question from another listener. This seems to be your area of expertise, so I want to put this question to you. Sean writes, I am a registered Republican. The last presidential election I voted in was when Ron Paul was running. I'm curious if I can vote Democrat in the upcoming primary. I have searched the internet at length and can't seem to find a solid answer. The only information I found was on changing my designation, and the deadline for that was this past October. So that's the question from Sean. What do you think, Cameron?
All I can say is that I only am familiar with the process here in Manchester.
Ah, okay.
And I'm not sure if we've reached the deadline yet with the city clerk. But I do know that, yes, in New Hampshire, you can get locked into a particular party. And if you don't update your registration before the election and you miss that deadline, unfortunately, you only have the option of voting, you know, Republican.
Well, hey, Cameron, thank you very much for having an extended conversation with me about this. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, thank you. You guys have a wonderful weekend.
Hey, you too. So, Nicole, you were nodding your head with respect to Sean's question. Do you have an answer for him?
Well, unfortunately, the deadline to have switched your party registration from Republican to Independent or to Democrat, I believe, was October 30th. That was right before the filing period here in New Hampshire. And so, unfortunately, if you are a registered Republican who wants to vote on the Democratic side, you cannot do that. Of course, we know that there are some Republicans on the ballot. We anticipate that President Trump will come out on top, but there still is a Republican primary you can participate in here in the Granite State. Only if you are an independent or an undeclared voter in New Hampshire can you then choose a red or a blue ballot or a red or blue poker chip, which is something that I just learned.
Poker chips. I mean, try explaining that to your students in France.
Oh,
Jake?
My God. A lot has happened since I last saw them in like 2017-18. The other thing I want to add to the gentleman from Manchester, I talked to Patty Murray, the Keene City Clerk, and I think for folks who have, you know, any level of concerns about the machines, which, you know, can be hacked, but it's difficult. And, you know, these clerks are able to, you know, log every time someone goes into a safe or a vault to deal with the memory cards or anything related to the machines. It's basically just them and a contractor. The other thing that Patty told me that was interesting over in Keene was that more often than not, when they test the machines in public about a week before primary day, they actually have found that sometimes people just get kind of tired and the hand counts are often more inaccurate by a couple votes than the machine count. And that was kind of her testament to, you know, the fact that we have this dual system in the populated areas is pretty sound and that it's in public and for everyone to see. And just the registration real quick, Bill Weld actually ran a bunch of ads, including in the Sentinel, for days in a row telling people about the registration. And yet, especially at Tulsi Gabbard events, I've heard from a number of Republicans who will say, you know, I'm voting for Tulsi. I'm like, great. Like, do you plan on voting the Democratic primary? And then they're like, oh, I missed the deadline. And it's, you know, I imagine her campaign does not like hearing that news.
Well, we've got to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll talk more about this. We've also got to talk a little bit about that candidate forum on climate change that happened this weekend. It's an issue that we know is on a lot of voters' minds this cycle. So, listeners, we want to hear from you. Whose climate change policies do you like most and why? Call us and let us know. The number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page. That's NHPR Exchange. This is the Primary News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello, and we'll be right back.
Support for The Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
I'm Peter Biello, and this is the New Hampshire Primary News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. Joining me today, CBS reporter Nicole Skanga, Jake LaHut, politics reporter for Business Insider, and Paul Steinhauser, political reporter who's been writing for The Concord Monitor, Fox News, and other outlets. Listeners, now's your chance to weigh in on anything related to the primary. We're going to talk in just a little bit about that climate forum that was held in Concord this week. So if you've got a climate change policy that you've heard from one of the candidates that you really like, tell us who said it, tell us whose policy it is and why you like it so much. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org. But before we get into that, Paul Steinhauser is telling us that we've got some breaking news here this morning. So one of the candidates in the Republican side, Republican Joe Walsh, has apparently suspended his campaign, Paul.
He did. He went on CNN and then he tweeted it out as well to say he's suspending his campaign. He is the former congressman, one term back in from Illinois. He got elected during that Tea Party wave back in 2010. Then he became a pretty popular conservative talk show host on radio. Gave that up to run for the White House, was very outspoken against Donald Trump, a major critic of the president, but was polling basically nowhere and now has suspended his campaign, 4 days before the primary. That leaves just former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld is the only one still in the race, also an extreme long shot against the president.
Jake, Nicole, your thoughts on Joe Walsh?
Well, it is interesting. He's been on a variety of TV programs. He's been on Bill Maher. He's gone on CNN. He's gone on MSNBC. And I think what's interesting about his pitch compared to Bill Weld, who I find very interesting in his own respect, is that he's kind of hearkening back to what the generous interpretation of the Tea Party messaging was, which is fiscal conservatism. You know, Trump is spending all this money and we're running up the debt. We're also doing these tax cuts without kind of any, you know, government cutbacks. And then he brings up the moral character kind of fitness for office argument, which honestly, because these Democrats want to run their own campaigns on their own terms, this is a tension that, you know, we've talked about for, I mean, a year and a half now, that they often don't bring up Trump at rallies that much to point out sometimes what may be, you know, an absurdity in the news that day or, you know, anything about his fitness for office. And you heard a lot more about that from someone like Joe Walsh.
Nicole?
Yeah, absolutely. And one other thing I would just add is that it is incredibly hard. If it was ever hard to run against an incumbent president, it is incredibly hard in a news cycle that is dominated by a very crowded Democratic field, an impeachment that seemed to last forever. I think it was about 3.5 months or so. And so one of the things that former South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford kept saying when he got out of the race around the time of the New Hampshire filing was that, you know, this president is just sucking up all of the oxygen in the room. There is no way that I can pitch my message to the American people. So we'll see if that's, you know, a similar reason that Joe Walsh gives. But it was a tough go for a lot of these guys just trying to, again, launch long shot bids to, you know, upend President Donald Trump's run.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that climate change forum. Several presidential candidates stopped by Concord on Wednesday to dig into the details of their climate change plans with voters.
Now, this is it. This is our moment. I am convinced we can do it, but we have to have a president that can bring people with her and talk about it in a way that makes sense to people.
If everybody is vulnerable to climate harms, everybody can participate in the solution. And that's the corner I think we have to turn in order to actually get anything done.
The economies of scale, the amounts of money that have to be spent or diverted in the environmental area are so massive that you can't really rely on a single business or a single individual to solve that problem. So it has to be the government.
That was In Order, Senator Amy Klobuchar, former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg, and Republican candidate and former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld sharing a little bit of their thoughts on climate change policy. Climate change, of course, seems to be extremely important to voters this time around. Nicole, which candidates have you heard speak on climate change? What have they been saying?
Well, certainly businessman Tom Steyer is one who says he is committed to climate change. It is absolutely his number one issue. We've also heard a lot about climate from Senator Bernie Sanders. I will say something that's quite interesting that all of these candidates have been getting at these town halls throughout New Hampshire is the question of if we shift away from fossil fuels, if we shift away from coal, what happens to the workers in those industries? I was with Senator Bernie Sanders on a recent swing through New Hampshire where he received not one, not two, not three, but four different questions about exactly that.
About what workers will do if
exactly. What will happen to workers? It was around the holidays. And certainly former Vice President Joe Biden also had a little bit of a mishap when he said, well, we'll teach the coal miners how to code. And it kind of became this regurgitated argument that we had back in 2016 after Secretary Hillary Clinton said, you know, we're going to put the coal mines out of business. Of course, I'm taking that out of context. She had a larger argument to make there. But again, we had this sort of repeat scenario where we're wondering if Democrats can truly win back parts of the middle of the country if they have this talking point. And last point I'll just make is after that, I reached out to a number of economic experts to ask, well, do government retraining programs work? And the answer that I received from a lot of these experts was maybe or a resounding no. There's not a lot of data out there that shows that government training works. Andrew Yang has sort of touted his freedom dividend as an alternative. But aside from that, we've not seen a lot of solutions from the candidates to address that specific issue.
Paul?
It's been a leading issue for Democratic presidential primary voters for over a year now, since this cycle began. You know, we talk about Tom Steyer. Before him, Jay Inslee, the Washington state governor.
Right.
It was his only issue. He's now, of course, running for re-election as governor after he dropped out of the race. And there was a huge push for months by grassroots organizers and others for the Democratic National Committee to hold a specific debate just on climate change. It just shows the magnitude of this issue on the Democratic side. And what the contrast is fascinating, too, because on the Republican side, you know, there is no such discussion going on.
Yeah, the one thing I've been interested in that I think goes under-discussed on the trails, a number of these candidates have plans for a dividend on either a price or a tax on carbon, which frankly is more of a semantic matter. It's kind of the same thing. And when I was at the Sentinel and we would hold editorial boards with the candidates, you know, a lot of it's kind of interesting, and we would often frame it, if you look at a country like France, you know, where they had the yellow vest protests, I think there are ways where, you know, a lot of climate change measures can disproportionately impact the poor, and there still isn't that answer other than, again, to Nicole's point about Andrew Yang. He also makes a kind of pragmatic argument as well when it comes to the fact that there's a lot of inertia here, and, you know, the science keeps showing that the projections tend to be more on the modest side. And he talks about, you know, what kind of government spending and action are we going to look at to mitigate, you know, just the simple disasters that are going to be exacerbated by
climate
change.
So when you say inertia, you're saying that government is slow to respond to predictions that might be way worse than scientists are saying?
And the just inertia of climate change itself, that like even if we were to enact some drastic measures, that, you know, a lot of the damage is going to keep getting worse. It's not like you can just sort of shut off the spigot, so to speak.
Right. Listeners, give us a call if you have questions or comments about the New Hampshire primary. If you've got a candidate that you are fired up about, or even better, if you haven't made up your mind yet, what are you still looking for in a candidate? We'd love to hear what your thinking is. We know by virtue of some polls that there are quite a few New Hampshire voters who still haven't made up their minds. So you are not alone if you haven't made up your mind yet. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And let's talk to Jill in Harrisville. Jill, thank you very much for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm just looking at the Iowa results and sort of thinking, well, how can you claim victory when you only got a quarter of the votes? I look at Bernie and Pete and the low turnout in Iowa, and I'm thinking they're claiming victory when maybe, you know, they didn't really turn on enough people. And if you have a quarter of the votes, there's 75% of the people who didn't vote for you who were active voters. And then there's all the ones that didn't come out at all. So I would like people, reporters, to look at this as, you know, this is still a very undecided electorate, and they're not sold on anyone yet, like me.
So, like you said, you haven't decided yet?
I haven't decided yet.
Okay.
Right now, my top two are Elizabeth Warren and Michael Bennett.
Oh, okay. So why are you having a hard time choosing between those two?
Well, I'd like somebody who has some seems to have some strength in the polling, which is Elizabeth. But then in one level of my heart is with Michael Bennett. All along, I've sort of felt like we've needed somebody from the Midwest or West who was calm, reasonable, sensible, and could bring a lot of people together. And I saw Michael Bennett this past week, and I think he's the guy. But right now, that's a real long shot. So I won't know until I go into the booth on Tuesday morning.
All right. Well, you've got some time, Jill. Thank you very much for calling. We appreciate it. So, yeah, to Jill's point about turnout, we kind of knew that the Iowa caucus would have a low turnout in part because of the nature of a caucus. You have to be there. You have to spend some time there. And if you can't get childcare, if you have to work, you can't really absentee caucus, right?
Very true. Their turnouts are always lower here proportionally. But here's the thing. Going into the Iowa caucuses, there was a hope by the Democratic Party out there that the turnout would be higher than it was in 2016 and maybe even equal the historic turnout, the highest they ever had, which was in 2008 when then-Senator Obama won there and obviously on his way to the White House. Well, they didn't come close. They kind of matched 2016. And the Republicans have picked up on this and are pointing out that, well, where's the energy on the Democratic side? We keep hearing about Democrats are so hungry they can't wait to vote President Trump out of office. Well, they didn't show up in record numbers in Iowa, and that is a concern for the Democrats.
Well, and it's a concern also because in 2016, it wasn't so much that President Donald Trump brought this unprecedented number of Republican voters out to support him. It was that Democrats stayed home. That was sort of the headline out of the 2016 general election. So this is a red flag in many ways for the Democratic Party. Also, one of the concerns of Democrats going into this really crowded primary race in 2020 was, you know, as that voter just voiced, that there would be no clear front runner, that it would be sort of jostling until the finish line. Could we have a brokered convention? Obviously, a very rare that we do, but still a very valid concern from voters that they won't feel like they have a real winner just because it is so crowded still.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hard to determine, Jake.
Yeah, and to our caller's point, I think one of the differences you saw with the rise of President Trump, and you see some distinctions in this field, would be how some of these candidates interact with their supporters. I think one of the reasons why Michael Bennett's going with the old school New Hampshire playbook, which is, let's do a lot of small venues, just take questions. It's very conversational. He knows his stuff on the issues.
And Jill was talking about him having her heart.
Right.
That's a big deal for some voters.
And this is what I think separates some of the candidates. I think Tulsi Gabbard and Andrew Yang are very similar. They also engage with supporters online, whereas the rest of the candidates, they have what I think a psychologist or a social scientist would call a parasocial relationship with voters, or a one-way relationship with voters, where they're giving the message and beaming it out. Now, Elizabeth Warren has things like the selfie line, their own little tricks. But I think that there's this kind of the lack of a fire people want to feel. I mean, obviously, everyone talks about wanting to beat Trump, but people remember how they felt if they voted for Barack Obama, this kind of feeling of inspiration. And I think that despite everyone wanting to make this super pragmatic argument that we want someone who can beat Trump, when you really sit down with voters and drill into it a little bit, they want something a little more. And I think that really depends on the candidate's style and how they actually interact with their supporters and people in New Hampshire.
Paul.
That voter's undecided, and all three of us talk to voters all the time, and we're still seeing, with just a few days left, plenty of undecided voters, and the metrics back that up. New Hampshire is traditionally known as late deciders. The most recent poll came out just a few hours ago from Suffolk University. 11% were still clearly, totally undecided, but of those who were backing a candidate, 45%, so we're talking almost half, said, well, I could change my mind by primary day. That's a high number.
Yeah, that's really high. So, listeners, we wanted to advise you that if you have questions or concerns about how to vote or the rules surrounding voting, definitely contact the Secretary of State's office or your local election officials. We do field questions from time to time about these, but if we can't answer them, we definitely want you to reach out firsthand. Like, for example, someone has asked, can I just write in any name? Like, can you write in a Republican on a Democrat ballot or vice versa if you didn't change your party affiliation by the timeline? Nicole, you might know the answer to this one, I guess?
I do. So you can write in just about anyone on your ballot. Unfortunately, because, say, if you're a Republican trying to vote for Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard is not running in the Republican primary. And so that vote, I don't want to call it wasted because every vote counts, but it won't go towards the contest that she's actually running.
So it's almost like two separate elections happening simultaneously.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for that answer. But if there's anything that you have questions about, listeners, again, definitely check with the powers that be. They know the official answer. Get it straight from their mouths if you can. Want to make sure that you have the right information going into primary day. Let's take another call and let's talk to Rod in New Hampton. Rod, thank you very much for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call. Good morning. I'm surprised that none of the candidates are aggressively attacking the president's foul character. If he was in our community, we would not vote for him for the school board or for mayor or for selectmen. If you would not buy a car from him. You would not buy furniture from him. You would not buy a house from him. He's untrustworthy, and he displays it all the time. He's so despicable, mm-hmm. and all of us were taught as children that lying was wrong, and all of us were taught that there was a distinct difference between between right and wrong, and it was really easy to determine what that is.
Well, Rod, thank you very much. So not a huge fan of the president, to put it mildly, Rod in New Hampton, but also his point that Democrats aren't talking enough about the president's character. What do you think? You're paying attention to the candidates. Does Rod have a point?
Yes.
Rod does have a point.
Jay. So Elizabeth Warren had a really big event last night. There must have been maybe 100 members of the national international press there. I mean, we're talking like maybe 20 camera rigs. Donald Trump's name, you know, was basically absent from her stump speech. Some people had questions that related to Trump. Betsy DeVos was mentioned implicitly, and that got a lot of, you know, folks riled up. But yeah, there's not a lot of red meat on Trump's character. And I think it's because of this. And this is the discussion that goes back to, like, we're talking early 2019, late 2018 stages. And then before that, the candidates who won the House for the Democrats in the midterms. And the successful strategy for them was don't talk about Trump. And there's this notion of, let's stick to the kitchen table issues. Let's talk about how the Democrats are strong on health care. We care about climate change. And they really try to keep that narrow focus. But I think that, you know, I talked to plenty of voters. There's an appetite for basically like who can dunk on Trump. This kind of fantasy that people play out of imagining a candidate next to him on the debate stage, whether he'll do them, I don't know. But like there is this notion of who can fight fire with fire. Remember, we were talking about Michael Avenatti running for president at one point. But it's gotten to this muddled territory where they don't want to alienate those Obama Trump voters, and they want to have a distinct message of their own and not just I'm the other option than Trump.
Oh, go ahead, Nicole.
I can't tell you how many times voters will say, what will you do if Donald Trump calls you a nickname on the debate stage? I've heard that question a handful of times. I will say the great thing about this primary is that there's a candidate for everyone. And so while Jake's absolutely right, many of the candidates do not bring the president up by name. Some of them do. Senator Amy Klobuchar frequently mentions that this primary is a quote unquote decency check on the president of the United States. Senator Michael Bennett pitches himself as the opposite of Donald Trump. Mayor Pete Buttigieg often asks that voters picture when the sun rises on Election Day and Donald Trump is no longer president.
And speaking of Pete Buttigieg, I mean, he made an interesting case recently about what he would bring to a debate stage or just any occasion to face and argue with the president. And he talked a little bit about himself and his position to do that. So let's listen.
Well, I appreciate the kind word, and I'm asking for everybody's help here to make sure that that I get to stand on that debate stage, because I believe this president ought to have to stand next to somebody who actually lives in a middle-class neighborhood in an industrial city in the Midwest. It's the exact kind of place that he talks about, but turns his back on. I think that if he wants to cloak himself in religion, he should stand next to somebody who is willing to hold him to account for that and talk about why, just like our flag, God does not belong to a political party in this country. And I think he ought to have to stand next to somebody who served this nation and have a real conversation about what it means to demonstrate and show, not just tell, your love for this country. So we're hoping to have exactly that conversation. Thank you.
Former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg speaking to voters recently about what he would bring to the debate stage when he faces Donald Trump. We've been talking about the week in primary news. We got to take a quick break. When we come back, though, a few other things happened this week. Historical things, of course. The president was acquitted on both articles of impeachment. What does that mean for the primary? Also, he gave his State of the Union address, signaling to voters on a variety of issues the things that he thinks he has done well, the president thinks he has done well. We want to hear your thoughts on the president. He's also coming to Manchester on Monday, the day before the primary. Give us a call. Let us know what you think. And if you are a Republican voter, what do you think of the Democrats? Is there a Democrat that you would like to see face President Trump, or one you are particularly afraid of? Let us know. 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. I'm Peter Biello, and this is the New Hampshire Primary News Roundup on The Exchange. Joining me today, CBS reporter Nicole Skanga, Jake LaHut, politics reporter for Business Insider, and Paul Steinhauser, political reporter who's been writing for The Concord Monitor, Fox News, and others. Listeners, and particularly supporters of the president, we'd love to hear from you on your views of the Democratic candidates. We've heard a lot from Democratic voters, but what about Republicans voting in the Republican primary next week. What do you think of the Democrats? Who would you like to see opposite President Trump on the debate stage when it comes time for the general election? Is there someone you prefer, someone you fear? We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange at nhpr.org. The president in his State of the Union address spelled out what he viewed as his achievements. He boasted of a strong economy. That seems to be a message that Democrats are going to push back on pretty hard. Presidents typically, Paul, tell me if I'm wrong, if they enjoy good economic conditions going into an election, that's a real strength for them.
Traditionally, yeah, it's
traditionally.
Traditionally, it is the.
Why
ultimate.
Do you qualify it that way?
Because this is nothing. No traditions anymore. Just this is not your father's election anymore. Traditionally, yes, but this president also has so much baggage. He has such a problem staying on message when it comes to the economy, which was interesting because he did stay on message in the State of the Union address. And I also got to say that was probably the most tense State of the Union address I've ever witnessed, even worse than some of those in the early years of President Barack Obama's administration, between the president refusing to shake Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker's hand, and then at the end, the House Speaker ripping up the president's speech. I think that was very symbolic of the nastiness, the partisanship that we're experiencing nowadays.
Yeah, it's a tough picture. Nicole, Jake?
I think what's really interesting in a way for Democrats to understand Trump, when they just kind of off, you often hear people say, when we're covering the Democratic primary, I just don't understand how someone could vote for this man. I think if you watch The Celebrity Apprentice, and it tends to be that I ask people this question, whether or not they did. And the one thing that was interesting about this State of the Union was it was kind of like almost beyond the parody of what you could have told someone. Like, imagine if Donald Trump were to win president. There was a troop family reunification. There were these kind of, you know, like made-for-TV feel-good moments with people in the crowd. It was a lot more of a show than usual. And then Nancy Pelosi kind of upped the ante with ripping up the speech. But you also had the doom and gloom. I remember the American Carnage inauguration speech. And I think that the thing the Democrats are going to have to contend with is Trump's able to very effectively have this pivot between the economy's booming. Look at especially a lot of the economic numbers he highlighted were for, you know, pretty much every demographic group you can imagine in the country, talking about, you know, unemployment among African-Americans being lower and down the line. But then he'll pivot it to the doom and gloom of, you know, people are dying because of XYZ and we need to be afraid of this or that. And it's very hard for a Democrat to say, well, is the economy good for whom? But also, you know, the norms that you're trying to rip apart are actually integral to what we stand for. It's a very, very tricky footing to stand on.
Listeners, our phone lines are lit up right now. We'd love to get your voice in if we can. So keep trying if you can't get in just yet. 1-800-892-6477. Nicole, did you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I mean, certainly a lot of drama during that State of the Union address. All of the Democratic women dressed in white as well,
right,
sort of adding to the theater of it all. I'll just say that for a number of voters who listened in, many told me either gleefully or regretfully that it kind of sounded like one of President Donald Trump's rallies, as though he was playing to his base. And so typically the State of the Union does tend to try to be more of a broad brushed, you know, appealing to both sides, kind of a solicitory remarks. This one, less so. But again, you know, not too surprising to have an untraditional State of the Union. As we pointed out earlier, these are not traditional times.
Let's go to the phones and talk to Brian in Canterbury. Brian, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
You're welcome. Hey, great program. Listen, I have a dream ticket. I made up my mind 3 weeks ago.
Okay.
I'm going for Mike Bloomberg, and I want his vice president to be Pete Buttigieg. Bloomberg's old, so I hope he just stays 4 years, and then Pete takes over for the next eight. That would be a dream ticket for me.
Thank you, Brian. So Bloomberg not on the ballot here in New Hampshire, but, you know, putting a lot of eggs in the Super Tuesday states basket.
Yes, he's spent already over $250 million. This is mind-boggling on ads in the Super Tuesday states and beyond. He's got the resources. This has never been done before. We've never seen a candidate sit out the early voting states and then enter the race on Super Tuesday. But we've also never had a candidate that's worth $55 billion. So Bloomberg's hoping for two things: A, that Bernie Sanders runs the table in the early voting states, and that Bloomberg is the savior for the moderate and establishment wing of the party. Or he's hoping for no clear front runner coming out of the early voting states, that, you know, Bernie obviously may have won one, or Buttigieg, or Biden, or Warren, and that he's sitting there waiting with all those resources, and that may play out.
Okay, well, that's one vote for the Bloomberg Buttigieg ticket. Let's talk to Mark in Dover. Hey, Mark.
Hey there. Yeah, I just wanted to. Well, I should be out canvassing for Amy Klobuchar right now, but I'm calling you instead. Yeah, I just wanted to push back a little bit on this idea of people having to be excited about a candidate. I mean, I am excited about Amy Klobuchar, obviously, but, you know, this is not a reality show. This is not The Bachelor. This is not America's Got Talent. This is the President of the United States. And my biggest fear is that people are not excited about a candidate. They won't work for that person, and God forbid, will not come out in November to vote for that person, you know, against Donald Trump. I mean, this is the great, when I canvass, this is, everybody says the same thing. Well, I'm undecided, but whoever, I'll vote for whoever can beat Donald Trump. Well, okay, that's great, but we have to pick that person first. And then, mm-hmm. in my case, if that person is not Amy Klobuchar, I'm going to have to figure out a way to get out there and just as enthusiastically campaign for that person. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we get four more years of Donald Trump. And the reason I think it's Amy is because she's in that middle lane. She doesn't run around and grab selfies and wave her arms. She just gets up and just talks and says what she's going to do and how she's going to do it. And I think she's brilliant. But my main point is about the, you know, having to get excited.
Well, that's a good thing to talk about, because, I mean, that's a part of the political discourse now. And there is a school of thought that says excitement matters. Like there's one school of thought now. I just read about this on Politico yesterday, that the theory that there are no swing voters. There are voters who are pretty likely to vote the way they vote. But the question is whether they come out and vote or not. And that is driven partly by excitement, either by excitement about a candidate or pure hatred of the incumbent. Like, Jake, you're nodding. Nicole, you're nodding. This is a familiar idea to you.
Yeah. I mean, to our caller's point, I think, you know, often we talk about polarization between right and left. There's also polarization between high information and low information voters, folks who pick up a couple minutes of news a week. And what gets people excited, and I think what you're seeing revealed, it was in part with Trump, but also I think even on the Democratic side, look at Tulsi Gabbard, Andrew Yang, Bernie Sanders, the candidates who have a lot of individual donors who have kind of fans at these events. They have the merch. What you're seeing is, I think, it's a pattern that fits with a lot of things in the internet age in general, which is you get rewarded for going niche. You get rewarded for, you know, instead of, like Nicole said, with the State of the Union used to be, you want to appeal to like 60, 75% of the country, broadly appealing, you know, Coca-Cola, American Pie sort of stuff. I think the way we're consuming information and just living our lives now, that's starting to kind of turn on its head, and you really get a lot more bang for your buck if you go narrow and deep.
Let's go to the phones again and talk to Pete in Newbury. Pete, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi there. I just wanted to say that as an independent, I voted on the Republican side last time around. And I'm really interested in seeing Pete Buttigieg on the ticket for the Democrats. And there's a couple reasons for that, but I feel like he has more experience actually running a government than anybody else except for, you know, a few people who are trying to buy their way in. But it feels to me like, I don't know, senators are more of a sales position.
Senators are salespeople in your view, but Mayor Pete, a little more closer to the nitty gritty of governing a place. Is that an argument you've heard in favor of Pete, Nicole, Paul?
Yeah. I mean, Pete's been making that argument for ages. So did Julian Castro, who was a mayor, and Bloomberg as well, that mayors deal with stuff that senators and presidents and governors don't deal with. You know, if the power goes out, if there's plumbing issues, the sewer system, they're on the front lines. That's their argument.
We get this note from Katie who says, I have met with both Elizabeth Warren and Pete Buttigieg and have been torn between the two for months. I made up my mind to vote for Elizabeth Warren last week because I think her experience and ideas are what we need, and I think she can inspire new voters. But then again, I feel the same way about Pete. And after his win in Iowa, I'm now back on the fence. I have heard a number of Biden supporters say that he's toast and they'll be voting for either Pete or Klobuchar. Going to a debate watch party tonight, and I'm sure it will lead to lots more opinions. So thanks, Katie. As we wrap up, I want to ask each of you what you'll be watching for in tonight's debate. We'll start with you, Jake.
So I really want to see, pretty much, is anyone going to make an effort to really criticize Bernie Sanders and to a lesser extent Joe Biden? But, you know, the voters have a pre-existing relationship with these figures. They go back together. And I think that that's been the challenge all along, is it's really hard to get at them when they have such a long-standing relationship with their voters.
I think two things. One, given Mayor Pete Buttigieg's momentum, will there be a pile-on towards him? Will we see a realliance between Senator Elizabeth Warren and Senator Bernie Sanders? And lastly, just on policy, we haven't seen a whole lot of discussion of opioids on stage.
Yeah.
We know that New Hampshire has been, you know, continues to get struck by this. So,
and Paul,
Biden's never been a great debater. He needs a huge debate tonight.
All right. Well, that's Paul Steinhauser, political reporter who's been writing for the Concord Monitor, Fox News, and others. Nicole Skanga of CBS, and Jake LaHut, politics reporter for Business Insider. Thank you all very much for being here today. Really appreciate
Thank you.
That.
Yeah, it was fun.
Thank you.
Listeners, I'm so sorry this is not a two-hour program because we have callers we weren't able to get to. Hopefully you'll give us a call next week as we break down the results. Hopefully we will know the results by then. If you ask Bill Gardner, Secretary of State, he says we likely will, but we'll see. Again, contact the Secretary of State's office if you have questions about the voting process. And remember, this conversation continues online on Facebook and at NHPR.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brinley is our program manager. Rebecca Lavoie has been bringing donuts and working the cameras for Facebook Live. And our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening and happy voting.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.